yen accounts, and clearly betting on a major shift in values from which a short-term profit was certain to take place. American stock values actually fell on the uncertainty, which surprised many of those who had their money on the street. Those holdings were mainly in mutual funds accounts because it was difficult, if not impossible, to keep track of things if you were a small-time holder. It was far safer to let professionals manage your money. The result was that there were now more mutual funds companies than stock issues traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and they were all managed by technicians whose job it was to understand what went on in the most boisterous and least predictable economic marketplace in the world. The initial slide was just under 50 points before stabilizing, stopped there by public statements from the big three auto companies that they were self-sufficient enough, thank you, in most categories of parts, to maintain and even boost domestic auto production. Despite that, the technicians at the big trading houses scratched their heads and talked things over in their coffee rooms. Do you have any idea how to deal with this? The only reason only half the people asked the question was that it was the job of the other half to listen, shake its collective head, and reply, "Hell no." At the Washington headquarters of the Fed, there were other questions, but just as few hard answers. The troublesome specter of inflation was not yet gone, and the current situation was unlikely to banish it further. The most immediate and obvious problem was that there would be, hell, one of the board noted already was, more purchasing power than there were products to buy. That meant yet another inflationary surge, and though the dollar would undoubtedly climb against the yen, what that really meant was that the yen would freefall for a while and the dollar would actually fall as well with respect to other world currencies. And they couldn't have that. Another quarter point in the discount rate, they decided, effective immediately on the close of the exchange. It would confuse the trading markets somewhat, but that was okay because the Fed knew what it was doing. About the only good news on that score was the sudden surge in the purchase of treasury notes, probably Japanese banks. They knew, without asking, hedging like hell to protect themselves. A smart move, they all noted. Their respect for their Japanese colleagues was genuine and not affected by the current irregularities, which they all hoped would soon pass. "Are we agreed?" Yamata asked. "We can't stop now," a banker said. He could have gone on to say that they and their entire country were poised on the edge of an abyss so deep that the bottom could not be seen. He didn't have to. They all stood on the same edge, and looking down, they saw not the lacquered table around which they sat, but only an infinity with economic death at the bottom of it. Heads nodded around the table. There was a long moment of silence, and then Matsuda spoke. "How did this ever come to pass?"
"It has always been inevitable, my friends," Yamata-san said, a fine edge of sadness in his voice. "Our country is like a city with no surrounding countryside, like a strong arm without a heart to send it blood. We've told ourselves for years that this is a normal state of affairs, but it is not, and we must remedy the situation or perish."
"It is a great gamble we undertake."
"Aye."
It was hard for him not to smile. It was not yet dawn, and they would sail on the tide. The proceedings went on without much fanfare. A few families came down to the docks, mainly to drop the crewmen off at their ships from a last night spent ashore. The names were traditional, as they were with most navies of the world, at least those who'd been around long enough to have tradition. The new Aegis destroyers, Congo and her sisters, bore traditional battleship names, mainly ancient appellations for regions of the nation that built them. That was a recent departure. It would have struck Westerners as an odd nomenclature for ships of war, but in keeping with their country's poetic traditions, most names of the combat ships had lyrical meanings and were largely grouped by class. Destroyers traditionally had names ending in kazi, denoting a kind of wind. Hatokazi, for example, meant morning breeze. Submarine names were somewhat more logical. All of those ended in ushio, meaning tide. They were in the main handsome ships, spotlessly clean so as not to detract from their workmanlike profiles. One by one they lit off their jet turbine engines and eased their ways off the quays and into the channels. The captains and navigators looked at the shipping that was piling up in Tokyo Bay, but whatever they were thinking, for the moment the merchantmen were merely a hazard to navigation, swinging at their anchors as they were. Below, those sailors not on sea and anchor detail mainly stowed gear and saw to their duty stations. Radars were lit up to assist in the departure, hardly necessary since visibility conditions this morning were excellent, but good practice for the crewmen in the various combat information centers. At the direction of combat systems officers, data links were tested to swap tactical information between ships. In engine control rooms, the snipes, an ancient term of disparagement for the traditionally filthy enginemen, sat in comfortable swivel chairs and monitored computer readouts while sipping tea. The flagship was the new destroyer, Mutsu. The fishing port of Tateyame was in sight, the last town they would pass before turning sharply to port and heading east. The submarines were already out there, Rear Admiral Yusuo Sato knew, but the commanders had been briefed in. His was a family with a long tradition of service, better still, a tradition of the sea. His father had commanded a destroyer under Raizo Tanaka, one of the greatest destroyermen who'd ever lived, and his uncle had been one of Yamamoto's wild eagles, a carrier pilot killed at the Battle of Santa Cruz. The succeeding generation had continued in those footsteps. Yusuo's brother, Torahiro Sato, had flown F-86 fighters for the Air Self-Defense Force, then quit in disgust at the demeaning status of the air arm, and now flew as a senior captain for Japan Airlines. The man's son, Shiro, had followed in his father's footsteps and was now a very proud young major, flying fighters on a more permanent basis. Not too bad, Admiral Sato thought, for a family that had no samurai roots. Yusuo's other brother was a banker. Sato was fully briefed on what was to come. The admiral stood, opened the watertight door on the Mutsu's bridge, and passed out to the starboard wing. The sailors at work there took a second to acknowledge his presence with dutiful nods, then went back to taking shore sights to update the ship's position. Sato looked aft and noted that the 16 ships in the column were in a nearly perfect line, separated by a uniform 500 meters, just becoming visible to the unaided eye in the pink-orange glow of the rising sun toward which they sailed. Surely that was a good omen, the admiral thought. At the truck of every ship flew the same flag under which his father had served. It had been denied his country's warships for so many years, but was restored now, the proud red-on-white sunburst. "Secure the sea and anchor detail," the captain's voice announced on the speaker system. Already their home port was under the visible horizon, and soon the same would be true of the headlands now on the port quarter. 16 ships, Sato thought, the largest force his country had put to sea as a coherent unit in 50 years. He had to think about it. Certainly the most powerful, not one vessel more than 10 years old, proud, expensive ships with proud, established names. But the one name he'd wanted with him this morning, Kuroshio, Black Tide, that of his father's destroyer, which had sunk an American cruiser at the Battle of Tassafaronga, unfortunately belonged to a new submarine already at sea. The admiral lowered his binoculars and grunted in mild displeasure. Black Tide. It was a poetically perfect name for a warship, too. A pity it had been wasted on a submarine. Kuroshio and her sisters had left 36 hours earlier, the lead ship of a new class. She was running at 15 knots for her high-speed transit to the exercise area, powered by her large, efficient diesels, which now drew air through the snorkel mast. Her crew of 10 officers and 60 enlisted men was on a routine watch cycle. An officer of the deck and his junior kept a watch in the sub's control room. An engineering officer was at his post, along with 24 ratings. The entire torpedo department was at work in their midships station doing electronic tests on the 14 Type 89 Mod C torpedoes and 6 Harpoon missiles. Otherwise, the watch bill was normal, and no one remarked on the single change. The captain, Commander Tamaki Ugaki, was known as a stickler for readiness, and though he drilled his men hard, his was a happy ship because she was always a smart ship. He was locked in his cabin, and the crew hardly knew he was aboard, the only signs of his presence the thin crack of light under the door and the cigarette smoke that came out the exhaust vent. An intense man there, skipper, the crewman thought, doubtless working up plans and drills for the upcoming exercise against the American submarines. They'd done well the last time, scoring 3 first kills in 10 practice encounters. That was as good as anyone might expect, except for Ugaki, the men joked at their lunch tables. He thought like a true samurai and didn't want to know about being second best. Ryan had established a routine in his first month back of spending one day per week at the Pentagon. He'd explained to journalists that his office wasn't supposed to be a cell, after all, and it was just a more efficient use of everyone's time. It hadn't even resulted in a story, as it might have done a few years earlier. The very title of National Security Advisor, everyone knew, was a thing of the past. Though the reporters deemed Ryan a worthy successor to the corner office in the White House, he was such a colorless guy. He was known to avoid the Washington scene as though he feared catching leprosy. He showed up for work every day at the same time, did his job in as few hours as circumstances allowed. To his good fortune, it was rarely more than a 10-hour day, and returned to his family as though he were a normal person or something. His background at CIA was still very sketchy, and though his public acts as a private citizen and a government functionary were well known, that was old news. As a result, Ryan was able to drive around in the back of his official car, and few took great note of it. Everything with the man was just so routine, and Jack worked hard to keep it that way. Reporters rarely took note of a dog that didn't bark. Perhaps they just didn't read enough to know better. "They're up to something," Robbie said, as soon as Ryan took his seat in the flag briefing room in the National Military Command Center. The map display made that clear. "Coming south?" 200 miles worth. The fleet commander's V.K. Chandrasekhara. Graduated Dartmouth Royal Naval College, third in his class, worked his way up. Took the senior course at Newport a few years ago. He was number one in that class, Admiral Jackson went on. Very nice political connections. He spent a surprising amount of time away from his fleet lately, commuting back and forth. Where to? Ryan asked. We assume back and forth to New Delhi. But the truth of the matter is that we don't really know. It's the old story, Jack. Ryan managed not to groan. It was partly an old story and partly a very new one. No military officer ever thought himself possessed of enough intelligence information and never fully trusted the quality of what he did have. In this case, the complaint was true enough. CIA still did not have any assets on the ground in India. Ryan made a mental note to speak to Brett Hansen about the ambassador. Again. Psychiatrists called his form of action passive-aggressive, meaning that he didn't resist, but he didn't cooperate either. It was a source of constant surprise to Ryan that important grown-ups so often acted like 5-year-olds. Correlation between his trips ashore and his movements? Nothing obvious, Robbie answered with a shake of the head. Sigint? Comment? Jack asked, wondering if the National Security Agency, yet another shadow of its former self, had attempted to listen in on the Indian fleet's radio traffic. We're getting some stuff via Alice Springs and Diego Garcia, but it's just routine. Ship movement orders, mostly. Nothing with real operational significance. Jack was tempted to grumble that his country's intelligence services never had what he wanted at the moment, but the real reason for that was simple. The intelligence he did have usually enabled America to prepare, to obviate problems before they became problems. It was the things that got overlooked that developed into crises, and they were overlooked because other things were more important until the little ones blew up.
So all we have is what we can infer from their operational patterns. And here it is, Robbie said, walking to the chart. Pushing us off, making Admiral Dubrow commit. It's pretty clever, really. The ocean's mighty big, but it can get a lot smaller when there's two fleets moving around it. He hasn't asked for an ROE update yet, but it's something we need to start thinking about. If they load that brigade onto their amphibs, then what? An army colonel, one of Robbie's staff, answered, Sir, if I were running this, it's real easy. They have troops on the ground already playing games with the Tamils. That secures the beachhead pretty slick, and the landing is just administrative. Getting ashore as a cohesive unit is the hard part of any invasion, but it looks to me like that's already knocked. Their 3rd Armored Brigade is a very robust formation. Short version is, the Sri Lankans don't have anything with a prayer of slowing it down, much less stopping it. Next item on the agenda, you gobble up a few airfields and you just fly your infantry forces in. They have a lot of people under arms. Sparing 50,000 infantrymen for this operation would not be much of a stretch for them. I suppose the country could degenerate into a long-term insurgency situation, the colonel went on. But the first few months would go to the Indians almost by default, and with their ability to isolate the island with their navy, well, whatever insurgents have a yen to fight things out wouldn't have a source of resupply. Smart money, India wins. The hard part's political, Ryan mused. The UN will get pretty excited. But projecting power into that area is a bitch, Robbie pointed out. Sri Lanka doesn't have any traditional allies, unless you count India. They have no religious or ethnic card to play, no resources for us to get hot and bothered about. Ryan continued the thought. Front page news for a few days, but if the Indians are smart about it, they make Ceylon their 51st state. More likely they're 26 states, sir, the colonel suggested, or an adjunct to Tamil Nadu for ethnic reasons. It might even help the Indians diffuse their own difficulties with the Tamils. I'd guess there have been some contacts. Thank you, Ryan nodded to the colonel, who had done his homework. But the idea is they integrate the place into their country politically, full civil rights and everything, and all of a sudden it's no story at all anymore. Slick, Ryan observed. But they need a political excuse before they can move. That excuse has to be a resurgence of the Tamil rebels, which, of course, they are in a position to foment. That'll be our indicator, Jackson agreed. Before that happens, we need to tell Mike Dubrow what he's going to be able to do about it. And that would not be an easy call, Ryan thought, looking at the chart. Task Group 77.1 was heading southwest, keeping its distance from the Indian fleet. But though there was an ocean in which to maneuver, not far to Dubrow's west was a long collection of atolls. At the end of it was the American base at Diego Garcia, a matter of some comfort, but not much. The problem with a bluff was that the other guy might guess it for what it was, and this game was a lot less random than a poker hand. Combat power favored the Americans, but only if they had the will to use it. Geography favored India. America really had no vital interests in the area. The U.S. fleet in the Indian Ocean was basically there to keep an eye on the Persian Gulf, after all. But instability in any region was contagious, and when people got nervous about such things, a destructive synergy took place. The proverbial stitch in time was as useful in this arena as any other. That meant making a decision on how far the bluff could be pressed. "Gets tricky, doesn't it, Rob?" Jack asked, with a smile that showed more amusement than he felt. "It would be helpful if we knew what they were thinking." "Duly noted, Admiral. I'll get people cracking on that." "And the ROE?" "The rules of engagement remain the same, Robbie, until the President says otherwise. If Dubrow thinks he's got an inbound attack, he can deal with it. I suppose he's got armed aircraft on the deck." "On the deck? Hell, in the air, Dr. Ryan, sir." "I'll see if I can get him to let another foot of lead on the leash," Jack promised. A phone rang just then. A junior staff officer, a Marine newly promoted to major's rank, grabbed it and called Ryan over. "Yeah, what is it?" "White House signal, sir," a watch officer replied. "Prime Minister Koga just submitted his resignation. The ambassador estimates that Goto will be asked to form the new government." That was fast.
Have the State Department's Japan desk send me what I need. I'll be back in less than 2 hours. Ryan replaced the phone. Kogo's gone? Jackson asked. Somebody give you a smart pill this morning, Rob? No, but I can listen in on phone conversations. I hear we're getting unpopular over there. It has gone a little fast. The photos arrived by diplomatic courier. In the old days, the bag would have been opened at the port of entry, but in these kinder and gentler times, the long-service government employee got in the official car at Dulles and rode all the way to Foggy Bottom. There, the bag was opened in a secure room, and the various articles in the canvas sack were sorted by category and priority and hand-carried to their various destinations. The padded envelope with 7 film cassettes was handed over to a CIA employee who simply walked outside to his car and drove off toward the 14th Street Bridge. 40 minutes later, the cassettes were opened in a photo lab designed for microfilm and various other sophisticated systems, but readily adapted to items as pedestrian as this. The technician rather liked real film, since it was commercial. It was far easier to work with and fit standard and user-friendly processing equipment, and had long since stopped looking at the images, except to make sure that he'd done his job right. In this case, the color saturation told him everything. Fujifilm, he thought. Who'd ever said it was better than Kodak? The slide film was cut and the individual segments fitted into cardboard holders, whose only difference from those any set of parents got to commemorate a toddler's first meeting with Mickey Mouse was that they bore the legend Top Secret. These were numbered, bundled together, and put into a box. The box was slid into an envelope and set in the lab's out bin. 30 minutes later, a secretary came down to collect it. She walked to the elevator and rode to the 5th floor of the old headquarters building, now almost 40 years of age, and showing it. The corridors were dingy, and the paint on the drywall panels faded to a neutral, offensive yellow. Here, too, the mighty had fallen, and that was especially true of the Office of Strategic Weapons Research. Once one of CIA's most important sub-agencies, OSWR, was now scratching for a living. It was staffed with rocket scientists whose job descriptions were actually genuine. Their job was to look at the specifications of foreign-made missiles and decide what their real capabilities were. That meant a lot of theoretical work and also trips to various government contractors to compare what they had with what our own people knew. Unfortunately, if you could call it that, ICBMs and SLBMs, the bread and butter of OSWR, were almost extinct, and the photos on the walls of every office in the section were almost nostalgic in their lack of significance. Now, people educated in various areas of physics were having to learn about chemical and biological agents, the mass destruction weapons of poorer nations. But not today. Chris Scott, 34, had started in OSWR when it had really meant something. A graduate of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, he'd distinguished himself by deducing the performance of the Soviet SS-24 2 weeks before a highly placed agent had spirited out a copy of the manual for the solid-fueled bird, which had earned for him a pat on the head from the then-director, William Webster. But the 24s were all gone now, and his morning briefing material had told him they were down to one SS-19, matched by a single Minuteman III outside of Minot, North Dakota, both of them awaiting destruction, and he didn't like studying chemistry. As a result, the slides from Japan were something of a blessing. Scott took his time. He had lots of it. Opening the box, he set the slides in the tray of his viewer and cycled them through, making notes with every one. That took 2 hours, taking him to lunchtime. The slides were repackaged and locked away when he went to the cafeteria on the first floor. There, the topic of discussion was the latest fall from grace of the Washington Redskins and the prospects of the new owner for changing things. People were lingering at lunch now, Scott noticed, and none of the supervisory personnel were making much of a big deal about it. The main cross-building corridor that opened to the building's courtyard was always fuller than it had been in the old days, and people never stopped looking at the big segment of Berlin Wall that had been on display for years, especially the old hands, it seemed to Scott, who felt himself to be one of those. Well, at least he had work to do this day, and that was a welcome change. Back in his office, Chris Scott closed his drapes and loaded the slides into a projector. He could have selected only those he'd made special notes on, but this was his work for the day. Perhaps the whole week if he played his cards right, and he would conduct himself with the usual thoroughness, comparing what he saw with the report from the NASA guy. "Mind if I join you?" Betsy Fleming stuck her head in the door. She was one of the old hands, soon to be a grandmother, who'd actually started as a secretary at DIA. Self-taught in the fields of photoanalysis and rocket engineering, her experience dated back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Lacking a formal degree, her expertise in this field of work was formidable. Sure, Scott didn't mind the intrusion. Betsy was also the office's designated mom. "Our old friend, the SS-19, she observed, taking her seat. "Wow, I like what they did with it." "Ain't it the truth?" Scott observed, stretching to shake off his post-lunch drowsiness. What had once been quite ugly was now rather beautiful. The missile bodies were polished stainless steel, which allowed a better view of the structure. In the old Russian green, it had looked brutish. Now it looked more like the space launcher it was supposed to be, sleeker somehow, even more impressive in its purposeful bulk. "NASA says they've saved a whole lot of weight on the body, better materials, that sort of thing," Scott observed. "I really believe it now." "Shame they couldn't do that with their goddamn gas tanks," Mrs. Fleming observed. Scott grunted agreement. He owned a Cresta, and now his wife refused to drive in it until the tank was replaced, which would be a couple of weeks, his dealer had informed him. The company was actually renting a car for him in their vain effort to curry public goodwill. That had meant getting a new parking sticker, which he would have to scrape off before returning the rental to Avis. "Do we know who got the shots?" Betsy asked. "One of ours, all I know." Scott flipped to another slide. "A lot of changes. They almost look cosmetic," he observed. "How much weight are they supposed to have saved?" He was right, Mrs. Fleming thought. The steel skin showed the circular patterns of the polishing rushes, almost like jeweling on a rifle bolt. "According to NASA, over 1,200 pounds on the missile body." Another click of the remote. "Huh, but not there," Betsy noted. "That's funny." The top end of the missile was where the warheads went. The SS-19 was designed to carry a bunch of them. Relatively small and heavy, they were dense objects, and the missile's structure had to account for it. Any intercontinental missile accelerated from the moment its flight began to the moment the engines finally stopped. But the period of greatest acceleration came just before burnout. At that point, with most of the fuel burned off, the rate at which speed increased reached its maximum, in this case about 10 Gs. At the same time, the structural rigidity lent to the missile body by the quantity of fuel inside its tanks was minimal, and as a result, the structure holding the warheads had to be both sturdy and massive so as to evenly distribute the vastly increased inertial weight of the payloads. "No, they didn't change that, did they?" Scott looked over at his colleague. "I wonder why. This bird's supposed to orbit satellites now." "Heavy ones, they say. Communication birds." "Yeah, but look at that part." The foundation for the warhead bus had to be strong across its entire area. The corresponding foundation for a communication satellite was essentially a thin steel annulus, a flat, sturdy donut that invariably looked too light for its job. This one was more like an unusually heavy wagon wheel. Scott unlocked a file drawer and removed a recent photo of an SS-19 taken by an American officer on the verification team in Russia. He handed it over to Mrs. Fleming without comment. "Look here. That's the standard structure, just what the Russians designed in, maybe with better steel, better finish." "They changed almost everything else, didn't they?" Fleming asked. "Why not this?" "Look that way to me. Keeping that must have cost them, what, 100 pounds, maybe more?" "That doesn't make sense, Chris. This is the first place you want to save weight. Every kilo you save here is worth 4 or 5 on the first stage." Both stood and walked to the screen.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, this fits the bus. They didn't change it. No mating collar for a satellite. They didn't change it at all. Scott shook his head. You suppose they just kept the bus design for their trans stage? Even if they did, they don't need all this mass at the top end, do they? It's almost like they wanted it to stay the way it was. Yeah. I wonder why. Chapter 14, Reflections. 30 seconds, the assistant director said as the final commercial rolled for the Sunday morning audience. The entire show had centered on Russia and Europe, which suited Ryan just fine. The one question I can't ask, Bob Holtzman chuckled before the tape started rolling again, what's it like to be the national security advisor in a country with no threat to its national security? Relaxing, Ryan answered with a wary look at the three cameras. None had their telltale red lights burning. So, why the long hours? Chris Hunter asked in a voice less sharp than her look. If I don't show up for work, Jack lied, people might notice how unimportant I am. Bad news. They still don't know about India, but they know something's up. Damn. He wanted to keep it quiet. It was one of those things that public pressure would hurt, not help. 4, 3, 2, 1. The assistant director jerked his finger at the moderator, a television journalist named Edward Johnson. Dr. Ryan, what does the administration make of changes in the Japanese cabinet? Well, of course, that's a result of the current difficulties in trade, which is not really in my purview. Basically, what we see there is an internal political situation which the Japanese people can quite easily handle without our advice, Jack announced in his earnest statesman's voice, the one that had taken a few elocution lessons to perfect. Mainly, he'd had to learn to speak more slowly. Chris Hunter leaned forward. But the leading candidate to take the prime ministership is a long-standing enemy of the United States. That's a little strong, Ryan interrupted with a good-natured smile. His speeches, his writings, his books are not exactly friendly, I suppose, Ryan said with a dismissive wave and a crooked smile. The difference between discourse among friendly nations and unfriendly ones, oddly enough, is that the former can often be more acrimonious than the latter. Not bad, Jack. You're not concerned? No, Ryan said with a gentle shake of the head. Short answers on a show like this tended to intimidate reporters, he thought. Thank you for coming in this morning, Dr. Ryan. A pleasure as always. Ryan continued to smile until the camera lights blinked off. Then he counted slowly to 10. Then he waited until the other reporters removed their microphones. Then he removed his microphone and stood up and moved away from the working part of the set. And then it was safe to speak. Bob Holtzman followed Jack into the makeup room. The cosmeticians were off drinking coffee, and Ryan took a fistful of handy wipes and passed the container to Holtzman. Over the mirror was a large slab of wood engraved on which was, "In here, everything is off the record." "You know the real reason behind equal rights for women?" Holtzman asked. "It wasn't equal pay or bras or any of that crap." "Right," Jack agreed. "It was forcing them to wear makeup. We deserved everything we got. God, I hate this shit," he added, wiping the pancake off his forehead. "Makes me feel like a cheap whore." "That isn't too unusual for a political figure, is it?" Kristen Hunter asked, taking wipes to do the same. Jack laughed. "No, but it's kind of impolite for you to say so, ma'am." "Am I a political figure now?" Ryan asked himself. "I suppose I am. How the hell did that happen?" "Why the fancy footwork on my last question, Jack?" Holtzman asked. "Bob, if you know it was fancy footwork, then you know why." Ryan motioned to the sign over the mirror, then decided to tap it to make sure everyone caught the message. "I know that when the last government fell, it was us who developed the information on the bribery scandal," Holtzman said. Jack gave him a look, but nothing else. Even no comment would have been a substantive comment under these circumstances. "That killed Gatto's first chance to become prime minister. He was next in line, remember?" Well, now he's got another. His patience is rewarded, Ryan observed, if he can get a coalition together.
Don't give me that.
Hunter leaned toward the mirror to finish cleaning her nose off.
You've read the stuff he's been telling their papers, same as I have. He will get a cabinet formed, and you know what arguments he's been using.
Talk is cheap, especially for somebody in that business, Jack said. He still hadn't quite made the leap of imagination to include himself in that business. Probably just a blip, one more politician with a few too many drinks under his belt who had a bad day at the office or the track. Or the geisha house, Chris Hunter suggested. She finished removing the makeup, then sat on the edge of the counter and lit a cigarette. Kristen Hunter was an old-fashioned reporter. Though still on the sunny side of 50, she was a graduate of Columbia's School of Journalism and had just been appointed chief foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Her voice was as dry as dust.
2 years ago, that bastard put a move on me. His language would shock a Marine, and his suggestions were, shall we say, eccentric. I presume you have information on his personal habits, Dr. Ryan.
Chris, never, ever, not even once, will I discuss what personal stuff, if any, we have on foreign officials. Jack paused.
Wait. He doesn't speak English, does he?
Ryan closed his eyes, trying to remember what his briefing documents had said on that point.
You didn't know? He can when it pleases him, but he doesn't when it doesn't. That day it didn't, and his translator that day was a female, about 27. She didn't even blush. Hunter chuckled darkly.
I sure as hell did. What does that tell you, Dr. Ryan?
Ryan had few doubts about the information that had come out of Operation Sandalwood. Despite that, it was very nice to hear this from a completely independent source.
I guess he likes blondes, Jack said lightly.
So they say. They also say that he has a new one now.
This is getting serious, Holtzman noted. Lots of people like to fool around, Chris. Goto loves to show people how tough he is. Some of the rumors about Goto are downright ugly, Chris Hunter paused.
I believe them, too.
Really? Ryan asked with the utmost innocence.
Woman's intuition?
Don't be sexist, Hunter warned, too seriously for the mood of the moment.
Ryan's voice turned earnest.
I'm not. My wife has better instincts for judging people than I do. I guess it helps that she's a doc. Fair enough?
Dr. Ryan, I know you know. I know the FBI has been looking very discreetly at a few things out in the Seattle area.
Is that so?
Chris Hunter wasn't buying.
You don't keep secrets about this sort of thing, not if you have friends in the Bureau like I do, and not if one of the missing girls is the daughter of a police captain whose next-door neighbor is SAC of the FBI's Seattle Field Division.
Do I need to go on?
Then why are you sitting on it?
Chris Hunter's green eyes blazed at the National Security Advisor.
I'll tell you why, Dr. Ryan. I was raped in college. I thought the bastard was going to kill me. I looked at death. You don't forget that. If this story comes out the wrong way, that girl and maybe others like her could end up dead. You can recover from rape. I did. You can't recover from death.
Thanks, Ryan said quietly. His eyes and his nod said even more.
Yes, I understand. And you know that I understand.
And he's the next head of that country's government. Chris Hunter's eyes were even more intense now.
He hates us, Dr. Ryan. I've interviewed him. He didn't want me because he found me attractive. He wanted me because he saw me as a blonde and blue symbol. He's a rapist. He enjoys hurting people. You don't forget the look in the eyes once you've seen it.
He's got that look. We need to watch out for this guy. You tell the president that.
I will, Ryan said as he headed out the door. The White House car was waiting just outside. Jack had something to think about as it headed for the beltway.
Softball, the Secret Service agent commented, except for after.
How long you been doing this, Paul?
14 fascinating years, Paul Robertson said.
keeping an eye on things from the front seat. The driver was just a guy from the General Services Administration, but Jack rated a Secret Service bodyguard now.
Field work?
Counterfeiters. Never drew my weapon, Robert added. Had a few fair-sized cases.
You can read people?
Robertson laughed. In this job, you'd better hope so, Dr. Ryan.
Tell me about Chris Hunter.
Smart and tough as nails.
She's right. She was sexually assaulted in college, a serial rapist. She testified against the mutt. It was back when lawyers were a little free with how they treated rape victims. You know, did you encourage the rat, stuff like that.
It got ugly, but she wrote it out and they convicted the bum. He bit the big one in prison, evidently said the wrong thing to an armed robber.
Pity, Robertson concluded dryly.
Pay attention to what she thinks, you're telling me.
Yes, sir. She would have been a good cop. I know she's a pretty fair reporter.
She's gathered a lot of information, Ryan murmured. Not all of it good. Not yet pulled together properly and colored by her own life experience. But sure as hell she had sources.
Jack looked at the passing scenery and tried to assemble the incomplete puzzle.
Where to? The driver asked. The house, Ryan said, drawing a surprised look from Robertson. In this case, the house didn't mean home.
Oh. Wait a minute.
Ryan lifted his car phone. Fortunately, he knew the number from memory.
Hello.
Ed.
Jack Ryan. You guys busy?
We are allowed Sunday off, Jack. The Caps play the Bruins this afternoon.
10 minutes.
Fair enough.
Ed Foley set the phone back in its place on the wall.
Ryan's coming over, he told his wife.
Damn it.
Sunday was the one day they allowed themselves to sleep. Mary Pat was still in her house coat, looking unusually frowsy. Without a word, she left the morning paper and walked off toward the bathroom to fix her hair. There was a knock at the door 15 minutes later.
Overtime? Ed asked at the door.
Robertson came in with his guest.
I had to do one of the morning shows. Jack checked his watch. I'll be on in another 20 minutes or so.
What gives? Mary Pat entered the room, looking about normal for an American female on a Sunday morning.
Business, honey, Ed answered. He led everyone to the basement recreation room.
Sandalwood, Jack said when they got there. He could speak freely here. The house was swept for bugs every week.
Do Clark and Chavez have orders to get the girl out yet?
Nobody gave us the executive order, Ed Foley reminded him. It's just about set up, but
the order is given. Get the girl out now.
Anything we need to know? Mary Pat asked.
I haven't been comfortable with this from the beginning. I think maybe we deliver a little message to her sugar daddy and we do it early enough to get his attention.
Yeah, Mr. Foley said. I read the paper this morning, too. He isn't saying friendly stuff, but we're laying it on them pretty hard, you know.
Sit down, Jack, Mary Pat said.
Can I get you coffee or anything?
No, thanks, M.P.
He looked up after taking a place on a worn couch.
A light just went off. Our friend Goto seems to be an odd duck.
He does have his quirks, Ed agreed. Not terribly bright, a lot of bombast once you get through the local brand of rhetoric, but not all that many ideas. I'm surprised he's getting the chance.
Why? Jack asked. The State Department material on Goto had been typically respectful of the foreign statesman.
Like I said, he's no threat to win the Nobel in physics, okay? He's an apparatchik. Worked his way up the way politicos do. I'm sure he's kissed his share of asses along the way.
And to make up for that, he has some bad habits with women, MP added.
There's a lot of that over there. Our boy Nomuri sent in a lengthy dispatch on what he's seen.
It was the youth and inexperience the DDO knew.
So many field officers on their first major assignment reported everything as though writing a book or something. It was mainly the product of boredom.
Over here, he couldn't get elected dog catcher, Ed noted with a chuckle.
Think so, Ryan thought, remembering Edward Keelty.
On the other hand, it might just turn out to be something America could use in the right forum and under the right circumstances.
Maybe the first time they met, if things went badly, President Durling could make a quiet reference to his former girlfriend and the implications of his bad habits on Japanese-American relations. How's Thistle doing? Mary Pat smiled as she rearranged the Sega games on the basement TV. This was where the kids told Mario and all the others what to do. Two of the old members are gone, one retired and one on overseas assignment in Malaysia, as I recall. The rest of them are contacted. If we ever want to... Okay, let's think about what we want them to do for us. Why? MP asked. I don't mind, but why? We're pushing them too hard. I've told the president that, but he's got political reasons for pushing, and he isn't going to stop. What we're doing is going to hurt their economy pretty bad, and now it turns out that their new PM has a real antipathy to us. If they decide to push back, I want to know before it happens. What can they do? Ed Foley sat on his son's favorite Nintendo chair. I don't know that either, but I want to find out. Give me a few days to figure out what our priorities are. Damn, I don't have a few days, Jack said next. I have to prep for the Moscow trip. It takes time to set up anyway. We can get our boys the comm gear and stuff. Do it, Jack ordered. Tell them they're in the spy business for real. We need presidential authorization for that, Ed warned. Activating a spy network in a friendly country was not a trivial undertaking. I can deliver it for you. Ryan was sure that Durling wouldn't object. And get the girl out earliest opportunity. Debrief her where? MP asked. For that matter, what if she says no? You're not telling us to kidnap her, are you? Ouch, Jack thought. No, I don't suppose that's a good idea. They know how to be careful, don't they? Clark does. Mary Pat knew from what he'd taught her and her husband at the farm all those years ago. No matter where you are, it's enemy territory. It was a good axiom for field spooks, but she'd always wondered where he'd picked it up. Most of these people should have been at work, Clark thought, but so did they, and that was the problem, wasn't it? He'd seen his share of demonstrations, most of them expressing displeasure with his country. The ones in Iran had been especially unpleasant, knowing that there were Americans in the hands of people who thought death to America was a perfectly reasonable expression of concern with the foreign policy of his country. He'd been in the field, part of the rescue mission that had failed, the lowest point, Clark told himself, in a lengthy career. Being there to see it all fail, having to scramble out of the country, they were not good memories. This scene brought some of it back. The American embassy wasn't taking it too seriously, business as usual after a fashion. The ambassador had all his people inside the embassy building, another example of Frank Lloyd Wright meets the Siegfried line design, this one located across from the Okura Hotel. After all, this was a civilized country, wasn't it? The local police had an adequate guard force outside the fence, and as vociferous as the demonstrators were, they didn't seem the sort to attack the severe-looking cops arrayed around the building. But the people in the street were not kids, not students taking a day off from class. Remarkably, the media never reported that so many of those student demonstrations coincided with semester finals, a worldwide phenomenon. In the main, these were people in their 30s and 40s, and for that reason the chants weren't quite right. There was a remarkably soft edge on the expressions. Embarrassed to be here, somewhat confused by the event, more hurt than angry, he thought, as Chavez snapped his pictures. But there were a lot of them, and there was a lot of hurt. They wanted to blame someone. The inevitable them, the someone else who always made the bad things happen. That perspective was not uniquely Japanese, was it? As with everything in Japan, it was a highly organized affair. People already formed into groups with leaders had arrived mostly by crowded commuter trains, boarded buses at the stations, and been dropped off only a few blocks away. Who chartered the buses, Clark wondered. Who printed the signs? The wording on them was literate, which was odd. He was slow to realize. Though often well-schooled in English, Japanese citizens messed up the foreign tongue as much as one might expect, especially on slogans. He'd seen one young man earlier in the day wearing a T-shirt with the legend, Inspire in Paradise, probably an exact representation of something in Japanese, and yet another example of the fact that no language translated precisely into another. But not these signs. The syntax was perfect in every case he saw, better, in fact, than he might have seen in an American demonstration. Wasn't that interesting? Well, what the hell, he thought. I'm a journalist, right? Excuse me, John said, touching a middle-aged man on the arm. Yes, the man turned in surprise. He was nicely turned out, wore a dark suit, and his tie was neatly knotted in the collar of his white shirt. There wasn't even much anger on his face, nor any emotion that might have built up from the spirit of the moment.
Who are you?
I am a Russian journalist for the Interfax News Agency, Clark said, showing an ID card marked in Cyrillic.
Ah,
the man smiled and bowed politely. Clark returned the gesture correctly, drawing an approving look for his good manners. May I please ask you some questions?
Certainly.
The man almost seemed relieved to be able to stop shouting. A few questions established that he was 37, married with one child, a salaryman for an auto company currently laid off and very upset with America at the moment, though not at all unhappy with Russia, he added quickly. He's embarrassed by all this, John thought, thanking the man for his opinion.
What was all that about? Chavez asked quietly from behind his camera.
Ruski clerk replied sharply.
Da, tovarish.
Follow me, Ivan Sergeyevich said next, entering the crowd. There was something else odd, he thought, something he wasn't quite getting. 10 meters into the crowd, it was clear. The people at the periphery of the mob were supervisory. The inside was composed of blue-collar workers, more casually dressed, people with less dignity to lose. Here, the mood was different. The looks he got were angrier, and though they became more polite when he identified himself as a non-American, the suspicion was real, and the answers to his questions, when he got answers, were less circumspect than he'd received before. In due course, the people moved off, guided by their senior leadership and shepherded by police to another place, one that had a stage prepared. That was where things changed. Hiroshi Goto took his time, making them wait a long time even for an environment in which patience was a thoroughly inculcated virtue. He walked to the podium with dignity, noting the presence of his official entourage arrayed in seats on the back of the stage. The TV cameras were already in place, and it was just a matter of waiting for the crowd to pack in tight. But he waited longer than that, standing there staring at them, with his inaction forcing them to pack in tighter, and the additional time merely added to the tension. Clark could feel it now. Perhaps the strangeness of the event was inevitable. These were highly civilized people, members of a society so ordered as to seem alien, whose gentle manners and generous hospitality contrasted starkly with their suspicion of foreigners. Clark's fear started as a distant whisper, a warning that something was changing. Though his trained powers of observation caught nothing at all beyond the usual bullshit of politicians all over the world. A man who'd faced combat in Vietnam and even more danger all over the world, he was again a stranger in a strange land, but his age and experience worked against him. Even the angry ones in the middle of the crowd hadn't been all that nasty. And hell, did you expect a man to be happy when he's been laid off? So it wasn't all that big a deal, was it? But the whispers grew louder as Goto took a sip of water, still making them wait, waving with his arms to draw his audience in closer, though this portion of the park was already jammed with people. How many, John wondered, 10,000, 15? The crowd grew quiet of its own accord now, hardly making any noise at all. A few looks explained it. Those on the periphery were wearing armbands on their suit coats. Damn, John swore at himself, that was their uniform of the day. The ordinary workers would automatically defer to those who dressed and acted like supervisors, and the armbands were herding them in closer. Perhaps there was some other sign that hushed them down, but if so, Clark missed it. Goto began talking quietly, which stilled the crowd completely. Heads automatically leaned forward a few inches in an instinctive effort to catch his words.
Damn, I wish we'd had more time to learn the language, both CIA officers thought. Ding was catching on, his superior saw, changing lenses and locking in on individual faces.
They're getting tense, Chavez noted quietly in Russian as he read the expressions.
Clark could see it from their posture as Goto spoke on. He could catch only a few words, perhaps the odd phrase or two, basically the meaningless things that all languages had, the rhetorical devices a politician used to express humility and respect for his audience. The first roar of approval from the crowd came as a surprise, and the spectators were so tightly packed that they had to jostle one another to applaud. His gaze shifted to Goto. It was too far. Clark reached into Ding's tote bag and selected a camera body to which he attached a long lens, the better to read the speaker's face as he accepted the approval of the people, waiting for their applause to subside before he moved on.
"Really working the crowd, aren't we?"
He tried to hide it, Clark saw, but he was a politician, and though they had good acting skills, they fed off their audience even more hungrily than those who worked before cameras for a living. Goto's hand gestures picked up in intensity, and so did his voice.
"Only 10 or 15,000 people here. It's a test, isn't it? He's experimenting."
Never had Clark felt more a foreigner than now. In so much of the world, his features were ordinary, nondescript, seen and forgotten. In Iran, in the Soviet Union, in Berlin, he could fit in. Not here. Not now. Even worse, he wasn't getting it, not all of it. And that worried him. Goto's voice grew louder. For the first time, his fist slammed down on the podium and the crowd responded with a roar. His diction became more rapid. The crowd was moving inward, and Clark watched the speaker's eyes, notice it, welcome it. He wasn't smiling now, but his eyes swept the sea of faces, left and right, fixing occasionally in a single place, probably catching an individual, reading him for reactions, then passing to another to see if he was having the same effect on everyone. He had to be satisfied by what he saw. There was confidence in the voice now. He had them. Had them all. By adjusting his speaking pace, he could see their breathing change, see their eyes go wild. Clark lowered the camera to scan the crowd and saw the collective movement, the responses to the speaker's words. Playing with them. John brought the camera back up, using it like a gun sight. He focused in on the suit-clad bosses on the edges. Their faces were different now, not so much concerned with their duties as the speech. Again he cursed his inadequate language skills, not quite realizing that what he saw was even more important than what he might have understood. The next demonstration from the crowd was more than just loud. It was angry. Faces were illuminated. Goto owned them now as he took them further and further down the path he had selected. John touched Ding's arm. Let's back off.
Why?
Because it's getting dangerous here, Clark replied. He got a curious look.
Nanja?
Chavez replied in Japanese, smiling behind his camera.
Turn around and look at the cops, Clark ordered.
Ding did and caught on instantly. The local police were ordinarily impressive in their demeanor. Perhaps samurai warriors had once had the same confidence. Though polite and professional, there was usually an underlying swagger to the way they moved. They were the law here, and knew it. Their uniforms were as severely clean and pressed as any embassy marines, and the handguns that hung on the Sam Brown belts were just a status symbol. Never necessary to use. But now these tough cops looked nervous. They shifted on their feet, exchanged looks among themselves, hands rubbed against blue trousers to wipe off sweat. They sensed it, too, so clearly that nothing needed to be spoken. Some were even listening intently to Goto, but even those men looked worried. Whatever was happening, if it troubled the people who customarily kept the peace on these streets, then it was serious enough. "Follow me,"
Clark scanned the area and selected a storefront. It turned out to be a small tailor shop. The CIA officers took their place close to the entrance. The sidewalk was otherwise deserted. Casual strollers had joined the crowd, and the police were drawing in also, spacing themselves evenly in a blue line.